Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Well, the world is watching the George Floyd trial, but it's not the George Floyd trial. It is the Derek Chauvin trial. Oftentimes, that has been confused. Today, opening statements from the prosecution and the defense. Witnesses were called to the stand, and the video of Officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on the neck of George Floyd was played for the jury in full. The judge has allowed cameras in the courtroom, so the world will be reliving those tragic events from last May. What will that mean for all of us? Tonight, we're discussing the psychological and legal ramifications of the Derek Chauvin trial. Will it and or does it trigger emotions in you? Joining us tonight, our guest, Dr. Alfie Noble, psychologist and founder of the ACOMA Project, a mental health nonprofit organization, and Lucius Outlaw, associate professor with Howard University School of Law. And the phone lines are open. We'd like to hear from you. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Alfie, let's begin with you. Let's start with the psychological angle here, because the 9:29 of that video was re-shown today to the jury. But because, as I said in the open, the cameras are there, all of us are seeing that. What kind of impact is that having on us all?
Absolutely. So thank you for having me. I'm a proud Howard University graduate, and it's wonderful to be here with you this evening. And the psychological impacts that I always speak to have to do with something called vicarious trauma. So just because you are not physically present for a traumatic event does not mean you cannot be impacted by it. So rewatching the television replay of this, for those who've never seen it, they're newly traumatized. For folks who have seen it, they're re-traumatized. And what it's doing for all of us, particularly those of us who are Black of the diaspora, is it is demonstrating to us how little, in real time, for many people, our lives mean. So in addition to watching the life being drained out of this our brother, George Floyd, we're also witnessing the callousness with which certain people in this country, how they view us as Black people, and that we're not important, that our lives don't matter to those people. So that vicarious trauma is real, and it's a re-traumatization pretty much for all of us.
Professor Outlaw, some of the specifics that we saw today, it seemed like the defense put up a real robust defense, where the prosecution sort of methodically went through what they were going to present to the jurors. What were your thoughts on what you saw today from the defense and the prosecution?
Well, thank you for having me. I mean, this is a case, right, that's going to be focusing a lot around the video, of course. But as a defense, they want to broaden the scope out, right? The prosecution wants to really focus in on those 9:29, particularly near the end when Mr. Floyd lost consciousness and no one has rendered aid. And they really want to focus like a laser light to have the jury focus on those minutes and those at that time. Whereas the defense wants to broaden it out. Right? They want to talk about the crowd and how the crowd was intimidating to the officers. They want to broaden it out to Mr. Floyd's drug use and heart condition. They want to broaden it out to the alleged crime he committed in passing a $20 counterfeit bill. They're trying to expand the world that is this case, whereas the prosecution wants it to be very narrowed on the 9:29. And so as a defense attorney, you're trying to throw anything in there to try to muddy up the water so the jury grapples with many other issues and doesn't focus in so intently on what the prosecution wants the jury to focus in on.
Can they successfully do that? And this is why I ask this. If many of us just use common sense, right, and we look at what happened and we see the defense saying, well, you know, he had used, there were some drugs in his system and he may have had a heart condition and some other underlying health conditions. But yet when we look at that video, as someone said, he was walking around prior to that. He had no issues. until Mr. Chauvin had his knee on his neck for over 9 minutes. So how can they sell that? I think as we look at that and you hear it and you know that's the defense that they have to take, but legally, is that a weak defense, or have you seen where that type of defense can be successful?
Well, it can be successful, and all rests on who's the jury and what the jury believes and wants to believe. And you know, this is really an issue, right, about causation, right? What caused the death of Mr. Floyd? And as you said, the defense is going to try to bring in all these other issues of drug use and his health condition, his weight, his heart. But what's important to understand, you know, the common sense versus the legal cause, right? Mm-hmm. And under the law, in criminal law, you don't have to be the only cause of someone's death to be guilty of their killing, mm-hmm. of their murder, right? That, you know, the way I always try to use hypos, I'm a law professor, if you just indulge me, right? If I'm going to if I'm going to poison someone and I use a poison and it normally takes them an hour, the poison normally takes an hour to kill an adult, right? But I poison someone, and because they have a heart condition, that poison I use triggers something in their heart condition, and they die in 20 minutes instead of an hour.
Right.
I can't come in there later and say, well, I didn't kill them because they died sooner than when I tried to kill them because of their heart condition. And that's going to be the real task of the prosecution to say, look, these all those things might be true, but in that moment, would he have died if not for Officer Chauvin? Is there enough of a close relationship between Officer Chauvin's conduct and Mr. Floyd's death to hold Officer Chauvin legally responsible for his death? And that is the real crux of the matter.
Dr. Alfie, I had mentioned that about the psychological impact, and I use the term all of us. Mm-hmm. And when I say all of us, I'm also talking about the jury, because even though we're seeing it, you know, on television, we're a distance away from it. They are in the courtroom. Mr. Chauvin is in the courtroom. And so most of them have probably seen it at some point before, but now they're seeing it sort of in a different environment, in a different context. How does that impact the jurors as they're sort of reliving that, not only seeing the video, but hearing the specifics, like the lawyer mentioned today, the prosecuting lawyer who had mentioned how Mr. Chauvin kept his knee on George Floyd's neck, even as paramedics arrived and were there about to remove the body. And I'll ask Professor Outlaw that question too, from a legal standpoint. But anyway, so how does it affect the jurors, Dr. Alfie?
Sure. So in addition to the vicarious trauma, you're also looking at the pressure that all of those jurors feel, whatever side of the aisle they're on, right? So I was talking about it earlier with my daughter, and we were talking about the racial breakdown of the jury.
Mm-hmm.
So for those jurors who are of color, clearly they recognize that there's the weight of all of us who are of color
mm-hmm.
looking at them thinking, y'all better get this right. and I think for the white ones, they're probably parallels on the side of people who are also white. Of course, not all white people think alike, so I don't mean to suggest that at all, but
right.
There's this idea that if you come from a certain perspective, there's only one answer and one conclusion you can draw from what happened. So they're feeling that weight. They're also sitting in real time with the person who they saw, to my colleague, the professor's point, contribute to this, right? So whatever, I know what I feel about it, but you know, I won't speak to that specifically, but I think if you look at, going back to his analogy with the poison, if I'm the person with the poison in my hand and I put the poison in the milk and the person drank the milk, regardless of whether it took 9 minutes and 29 seconds, which I watched the prosecutor say multiple times, it was clear to me that he was using a psychological strategy of imprinting on the jurors' minds this timestamp so that you understand exactly how long this took. And so listening to all of that, I can only imagine that for those folks, the weight and the pressure that they feel from outside forces, in addition to being re-traumatized and having to relive this experience with the person who is on trial for causing George Floyd's death right there in the room. So all of that is very heavy. It can be very anxiety-producing. And, you know, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. That's a lot of pressure on those folks.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight we're talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, its impact from a legal standpoint and psychological standpoint, how it might affect all of us as we go through this trial, which could last up to a month. We'd like to hear from you, your comments or questions. 202-319-7810. Dr. Outlaw, I had said at the top also about it's not the George Floyd trial, and Ben Crump fervently made that point today outside the courtroom, that George Floyd is not on trial, but Derek Chauvin. And so we often hear that interchanged, you know, the George Floyd trial, or sometimes it's referred to as the Derek Chauvin trial. Does it matter how that trial is referred to?
I mean, I think it does matter because it sets up a expectation, right, of what has to be proven here, right? If you call it the George Floyd trial, it's, you're almost setting up an expectation of proving that George Floyd didn't do something to cause his own death, that
yes.
he is partially responsible for his own death, partially or fully responsible. And so I do think it matters how you characterize it, because it sets an expectation about what the government has to prove. Right? The government doesn't have to prove that George Floyd was not complicit in his own death. They have to prove that Officer Chauvin was responsible. So those labels do matter.
Labels matter. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Again, the Chauvin trial, not the Floyd trial. Let's go now to the phone lines. William is calling from Virginia. William, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Well, when I looked at it from the beginning, I saw him across the street with Officer Chauvin. And when him and the other officers, when they walked on the other side of the street, when he had him down on the ground, before he even had him on the ground, I seen that he was being complicit. So therefore, he wasn't struggling with the officer or giving him a hard time. But it's like Chauvin just started using brutal force.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he put his knee on his neck, if we really look at it, he had his hand resting in his pocket. That's the part that really got to me. Because why would you have your hand resting in your pocket and just keep your knee on his neck for that long period of time unless you were trying to kill him?
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, William. And I want to follow up on what William had to say in terms of, I never noticed that Chauvin had his hand in his pocket, Professor Outlaw. So I think what's going to happen as that video is replayed and replayed, more specific things that we may not have caught before, and especially the jury will see these types of things. So beyond just the initial kind of shock of re-seeing that video, can you sort of dive into really the role the video will play? Will it play a just super prominent role, or will it just kind of be one part of the trial, or will it just always be sitting there, no way to get around it?
I mean, I think it's a combination. I think it's the element that everybody sees that nobody can get out of the room.
Okay.
And it is going to dominate. There's going to be other issues. There's going to be expert testimony about the cause issue, the drugs and his heart condition. But the focus is going to be on the video, and I think the prosecuting attorney, Mr. Jerry Blackwell, did a great job of that in opening. You know, he said the 929, he said those are the three most important numbers in this case,
mm-hmm.
and repeated over and over again. And what's key to the prosecution is not just saying, okay, there's this video 9, but they break it down into segments. They talked about how the first 4 minutes and 45 seconds was with Officer Chauvin kneeling on Mr. Floyd while Mr. Floyd was calling for help. Then the next 53 seconds is Mr. Floyd having seizures and flailing. And then the final 3 minutes and 51 seconds, Mr. Floyd is unresponsive and Officer Chauvin is still putting his knee on his neck. And so what the prosecution is doing is picking that moment in time and expanding it out, so the jury can kind of see it in kind of frame by frame, piece by piece. And so they can really get a sense of what Officer Chauvin's mental state is, because that's the issue. When you're talking about is somebody responsible for murders, what is their mental state, right? And we don't have a machine that can go into somebody's head and say, what were you thinking at that moment? So we have to infer it from their actions. And that's why kind of slowing it down and going it piece by piece is so important to the prosecution. Whereas at the defense, as they say in their opening, there's 50,000 other pieces of evidence. So this is beyond the 929. And so what they're going to try to do is throw everything else up at the wall around this 9 minutes and 29 seconds to try to show that Officer Chauvin's not responsible. And going back to your point, the doctor's point about the pressure, the defense here, you know, they're of course trying to get acquittal, but considering the makeup of their jury and the diversity of their jury, you know, I'm thinking they're really going for a hung jury. He just needs mm-hmm. to get one person mm-hmm. to agree with him. Mm-hmm. And there'll be a hung jury, and then the government has to decide they want to keep retrying this and retrying it. So sometimes getting a hung jury, a stalemate, is a victory from the defense, and that's maybe mm-hmm. where the prosecution is trying to angle.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before we go to break, let's go back to the phone lines very quickly. James, go right ahead with your question or comment, calling from Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Yes, I have a comment. This jury and this death should have been tagged as a premeditated murder because COVID, Chauvin, and George Floyd knew each other. They both worked as security officers at a nightclub, and the lady who was over both of them saw George Floyd fired the police officer. So this was more like premeditated murder.
And I suspect, James, hold your thought real quick because I want you to finish that, and I suspect that that's going to come up in the trial. We're going to go to break, but James, don't hang up because I want you to finish the point that you're trying to make. You can hear every edition now on the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com, or you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. If you're on the phone, hang right there, James. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM XM 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Bramante Bryant. The original Quiet Storm is next on WHUR. This discussion continues on SiriusXM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 on your analog radio. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Tonight we are talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, which really kicked into an intensive gear today with opening statements from the prosecution and the defense, and we had witnesses take the stand. Joining us tonight to talk about the legal and psychological impact of this trial is Dr. Alfie Noble, a psychologist and founder of the ACOMA Project, a mental health nonprofit organization, and Lucius Outlaw, associate professor at the Howard University School of Law. Again, the phone lines are open, 202-319-7810. And James, I want you to finish your comment. I know you had started off saying this was really a premeditated situation, and you feel like that Officer Chauvin had been charged with premeditated murder?
Yes. I said that because, like I said, both of those guys knew each other. They worked as security officers at this young lady's nightclub, mm-hmm. and they had been working together for years.
Right.
But the lady finally put George in charge, and George ended up firing that police officer for racial tendencies and mistreatment of other minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady agreed. So he targeted him and had somebody to call in when George Floyd went to that store to get some items.
Right.
So all this stuff, hopefully it does come out, because this is more like premeditated murder for him to keep his neck on the man, drag him out of his vehicle, intentionally call for backup, and wouldn't let him go. All those things that made it worse, because George knew him, and he wasn't trying to resist arrest or nothing like that.
All right. I think you're right. Thank you, James. I think you're right. I think it is going to come up in the trial. Dr. Alfie, I mentioned that there were some witnesses on the stand today, the 911 dispatcher and a young lady who was a witness. I believe her name was Alicia Euler, if I'm pronouncing that right, O-Y-L-E-R. And that young lady seemed, if you saw it, to really be just thrown or nervous. She was a prosecution witness, it appeared, but it seemed like she kind of was just off kilter in sort of answering questions. And so when we're talking about psychological impact, Was that just a situation of, well, you're on a stand in a courtroom, you can get nervous? Is it the weight of the international implications of this trial? Speak to that a little bit about witnesses. What kind of a psychological impact a trial like this will have on those who will have to sit in that witness stand?
Absolutely. So, you know, as we've been speaking to throughout this conversation, there are these pre-existing conditions of which we may never know, right? So there's the idea that maybe for both of those, the people that you mentioned, they're coming into this with some pre-existing psychological, I'm not saying that they have psychological problems, but they may be anxious people. They may be nervous people in general. They may be people who struggle with managing their anxiety. And I think when you have that, just speculatively, when you have that and you layer on top of that what you just spoke to, which is the weight of the trial, that's just going to exacerbate anybody's anxiety. Now, let's say that neither one of them has any of those kinds of issues. Well, the trial in and of itself is really going to generate those kinds of feelings in you because, again, you're in a situation where you know that people are looking at you to get this right. And, you know, on top of that, this is a murder trial, right? Mm-hmm. This is not like somebody got a ticket and they're trying to get out of jaywalking. This is about one human being, Chauvin, taking the life of another human being. And as we all know, it was needless. It was senseless. And so knowing that, that carries weight with it, too. There's also how you're being questioned. The questions are being asked of you. You know that there are two sides in there. There's one side who's going to give you space to speak to what you believe to be the truth. There's the other side who's going to try to unravel it from you. So I think that knowing that and sitting with the weight of that, it would mess anybody up. I will say the 911 operator came across as very calm from what I saw, very cool. So I don't think it got to her, but the other young person, absolutely.
Well, I would probably think, too, Dr. Alfie, you know, 911, she's got to handle all kinds of things coming at her this young lady was just a witness and, you know, didn't seem, I don't know if it was the pressure again, and you can you know, sort of diagnose that better than I can. But just in layman's terms, it just seemed like, boy, if you're supposed to be a prosecution witness, she didn't come across. She was a little shaky. Good way to refer to that. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Professor Outlaw, how is this trial different from other cases? And I think we all can sort of look back on the Rodney King case, and there was video, there was violent video, there was graphic video. We all saw it. And then when, you know, there were charges were dismissed, everyone was shocked, rioting ensued. Here we have video. So it seems like it's similar, and then you add the audio to it. So I might be answering my own question before letting you answer it. But how does this stack up against similar cases? And do you see it in connection to any other cases that we may have seen in the past? Or is it just so different that it's hard to compare?
Well, I do think the Rodney King is a apt comparison. And, you know, we're in a different moment in time. We have people have a broader understanding of policing and policing of people of color and the problems associated with that. We also have people be able to react to things in instantly through social media and the internet, and how, you know, Rodney King, like the video, but it took, you know, some time to get it on TV and pass around. You just couldn't go to the internet and just pull it up and watch it anytime you wanted.
Right.
We can watch this video over and over again, and it spurred a whole movement and propelled a whole movement over the summer. And so it has the world watching in real time, which is something kind of different than the King. And so I think there is that added, those eyes and that different understanding, this moment in time does offer some comparison. Does that mean it's an automatic guarantee conviction? Absolutely not. Because unfortunately in this country, there's a long history of people being unwilling to convict officers for misconduct that leads to harming or death of Black people, especially when they're police officers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hope and pray that this moment of time leads to a different outcome. But you can never say never. That's why the trials happen. You just never know.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The trial of Derek Chauvin kicked into top gear today with opening statements from the defense and the prosecution. Dr. Alfie, we're going to be watching this, but I'm wondering, should some not watch it? And what I mean by that is, like, my kids are high school. I've got a senior and a sophomore, so they're on spring break. And MSNBC, CNN, these cable networks are running it, you know, unfiltered all the way through. You have college kids who may be on spring break who can sit down if they're, you know, not down somewhere in Miami doing what they probably shouldn't be doing, can sit and watch it. Should some of us not watch it? Should we all watch it to learn? Should we just watch it in part? How should we be viewing this on television in terms of age, groups, demographics, gender, wherever you think it may fall?
That's a wonderful question, and I so appreciate you opening the door to that. So what I tell people, a lot of times people don't like to hear it, but being someone who treats people who deal with anxiety, who deal with depression, who deal with the after effects of racial stress and racial trauma, we have to acknowledge that those things are real. There is such a thing as racial trauma. If you are a person of color, we're going to speak to black folks tonight. If you are black in the United States, you're dealing with racial trauma. It impacts you every day. So you don't necessarily need to put your eyeballs on what we're going to see and hear over the course of this trial daily, right? So I think it's important to consume, but how you consume is just important. And I do tend to break that down along demographic lines. So my children, interestingly, are exactly the same age as yours, 10th and 12th grade. And, you know, part of the issue is they may not have the same kind of filter for us given their maturity level. It's not that they're immature, but developmentally, they may not be in a place where they need to see that. And so as parents, it's really our job to censor and make sure that we feed that kind of information to our children in a way that they can digest. Well, that means you got to pay attention to your kids, and that means you have to be cognizant of what your kids can take in. So I told my oldest, don't watch it, right? We had that conversation this morning. Stay off of social media, because that's everything that's going to be there. So
that's tough now, Dr. Alfie. Stay off social media?
Yes, she is. She completely took herself away.
Well, you need to send me a note. You need to send me a note then how you did that, but okay.
Her mom,
that's another show.
That was all her. So she's been off for about 6 months because she just said it was too much for her.
Oh, wow, okay.
But she also is an anxious kid because she has an anxious mom, and we have anxiety in my family. And so, you know, that's just one example, and that's extreme. I think for not just for kids but for adults as well, we have to pay attention to what we can tolerate. So if you can't watch it but you want to be conscious, read it. Because in reading, you're not getting this imprint in your brain of 9 minutes and 29 seconds with Chauvin's knee on this brother's neck,
right,
and on his back. So you have to be, like, really careful. I tell people all the time to curate their news. And the one other thing I'll say is I tweeted about this today, that we have to be super mindful of when and how we consume. And remember, if you're not watching, that does not mean you're less woke than other people. There are other ways you can support the cause rather than re-traumatizing yourself, sitting glued to the TV, watching it on a loop endlessly 24/7.
Wow, that's an excellent point, especially at, you know, that angle about woke, you know, and so you can be ostracized if you're, and I'm in a profession, you know, where I've got to watch this stuff, and you have to know it, but it's easy for, I think, for us to look at those who aren't up to speed on these things and say, wait a minute, how can you not be watching that? How can you not see what's happening there? Dr. Outlaw, And your last name, every time I say that, and I'm talking to an attorney, and I say Outlaw, and I know you get that all the time, but I just had to share that with you. I love that last name.
It's all good, yes.
Okay.
It's all good.
Dr. Outlaw, Jerry Blackwell said, and I'm sort of paraphrasing in his opening statement, I think he said something like, listen, this isn't about politics, you know, this isn't about policing, you know, this is really about what one officer did and what we're trying to prove that he did. How did you feel about that? Was that a way for him to sort of not get caught up in falling into a trap that the defense may lay for him?
Oh, that's definitely about avoiding a trap and having the jury avoid the trap of the defense coming up and saying they're trying to indict a whole profession or they're trying to indict a whole police department. And what he's saying is, like, don't be fooled by those red herrings. Don't be fooled by that sideshow. It's just smoke and mirrors. We're talking about one man putting his knee on another man's neck until he died and focusing. That's why he kept saying those three most important numbers are 9, 29.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's definitely about trying to, you know, have the jury be mindful of that trap and trying to avoid it, because what he's trying to say is, like, look, you don't have to find all the Minnesota police officers guilty to find Chauvin guilty. You don't have to find all police officers in the world guilty to find Chauvin guilty. You have to find that Chauvin is guilty, and here's the reasons why he's guilty.
But in essence, Professor Outlaw, is policing on trial here, though, along with Chauvin?
It's always going to be an undercurrent just because of the time we are in. And this decision, how it comes out, is going to send a message about policing and the valuation of black lives and how police value black lives. So, of course, there's a larger implication and consequence from this trial. But to get the conviction, I think the prosecutor is saying, look, you don't have to grapple with those larger issues, that you need to just be laser focused. But, of course, you know, the policing and policing of black people is very much in a defendant seat next to Chauvin as anything else.
Mm-hmm. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Alfie, I was watching on demand last night Queen Sugar, mm-hmm, and the latest episode, and they dealt with the George Floyd issue. I guess they had, you know, we're trying to catch up on a timeline. And I thought it was fascinating because in one of the scenes, I can't remember one of the sisters' names, the darker-skinned mm-hmm, young lady.
An activist. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And she had, mm-hmm, said to her white boyfriend, do you have, was there any impact when you watched that video as a white man of a white officer putting his knee on the neck of a black man? Because as black people, we take on everything other black people do because we know how it then will be a large, you know, net will be cast on all black people. And so, you know, I have about a minute until I break, but mm-hmm, how important, how impactful is race in a case like this?
Race is central. And we all know it, and that's part of the issue. That's why there's so much angst about it. For those of us as black people, it's not just that we know that it exists in the world, these things that happen, it's that we personally live with people this could happen to. I have a son, I have a father, I have a brother, I have a spouse. My spouse is a man, a black man. And so, you know, in all of these instances, this is visceral. We have visceral reactions to this, and we all have stories of people who've been harassed or held up. And we've worried when our loved ones have left the house. So race is central, and it's a central part of our psyche. It's a central part of the fabric of this country, and you cannot get around that, even in this trial.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The phone lines are still open. And Dr. Alfie, thank you for referring to the young lady as the activist, you know, not necessarily by her color, which I did, but I couldn't think of her name, but I appreciate you making that second reference, which is most important. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, its impact psychologically and legally. We still have time to get your phone calls in. We're going to continue this conversation right after this timeout. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Dr. Outlaw, there have been comments that there could be up to 400 witnesses in this trial. Is that possible? Even in a 4-week trial?
Anything's possible. And it's important to understand that some witnesses could be there for 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
Like the one side needs to get a certain piece of evidence in, and the rule is you have to have a witness to get a piece of evidence in. So it could be, you know, somebody could just be up there just to say, yeah, this is the piece of evidence, it is what it is, and to be admitted. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be more substantive witnesses. So it is possible, but generally as these things happen, as a trial goes along and each side reassesses where they are in their case, they make decisions throughout the trial to drop certain witnesses. And so oftentimes as the trial goes on, things get tighter, people make decisions like, well, we don't need two witnesses to talk about the same thing. Right. So I anticipate that, you know, people they put on the list, and oftentimes you just put people on the witness list just so if you want to call them, you can, and the other side can't say, oh, that's a surprise, they weren't on the witness list. So you are very overly inclusive, but you don't call everybody that you put on your witness list.
Sure. Dr. Alfie, George Floyd's family was there today and have been there during the trial, you know, in the jury selection. But today they were very vocal. They're reliving this.
Yep. 100%.
What if you were advising them, what would you tell them as this trial moves on?
I would honestly tell them to take it in ships. And I say that as a person who was traumatized by the death of my mother. Mm-hmm. She died from cancer. And so I know it's not exactly the same thing because her life was not taken from her in the same way. But I do believe that some of the same principles apply. There are certain family members who have the, I don't know if you call it intestinal fortitude or, you know, I don't know, the temperament, mm-hmm. the ability to sit there every single day for this whole month that they anticipate that it's going to last or however long it lasts. There are other ones who are not going to be able to do that. So I think one of the things I would advise is say, get together as a family and figure out who are the ones who can do it every day, who are the ones who need to come in and out, and how are you all going to manage that for each other. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is be very careful about how much of this you're consuming when you're outside of the courtroom, when you're away from the court, because you may have to concentrate and focus your energy and get all of your insides and your mind and your body and spirit together to be physically present. But when you're away, you may not be able to do that. The other thing I always tell everybody when they're dealing with these kinds of traumas, when they're dealing with any kind of trauma in real time, being re-traumatized, is you have to pace yourself. You have to build up your reserves before you go in. So you don't just stay up all night and then go into the courtroom because you're going to be fatigued. And mm-hmm. if you're fatigued, that means your reserves are not built, which means you're going to be more susceptible to the ebbs and flows of emotions. And you need to be managing all of that. And the final thing I say is always make sure you're taking care of the children. He has a daughter. She's 6 or 7 years old. They have to really, I would advise, my hope would be, and they probably are, really limiting how much of that you expose that child to. She right. does not need that at this age, and there's plenty of time for her to get all the details as she gets older and more mature.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Still have a few moments left if you want to get a call in, question or comment about your emotions as you're watching today's trial. Professor Outlaw, Al Sharpton said today, standing with the family and the lawyer for the family, that Derek Chauvin is not simply on trial, but America is on trial. What do you think he meant by that?
What I took that to mean is that America's on trial of finally they're going to come and reckon and deal with what they call the original stain, mm-hmm. right? That of racism in this country. Is this going to be the moment where white America in particular acknowledges a long history of racism and white supremacy and all that has caused and wreaked havoc, not only in this country, but in this world? Mm-hmm. Is this going to be the moment where they're going to take some accountability? And that's what I took from that statement, that, you know, with this video, there is no denying what is behind it, what was driving Chauvin, and is white America finally going to acknowledge it and be held accountable and begin to address the hundreds of years of exploitation of black people and degradation of black people in this country?
And Dr. Alfie, as Dr. Outlaw has sort of laid that out, right, in the history that many of us of color sort of connect to this trial. As we're watching this, and I watched earlier today, I think it was T.J. Holmes, who works at ABC News, and they went to him for comment, and I thought it was interesting because he wasn't there. But, you know, I took it as like, okay, we have an African-American anchor correspondent. Let's see what he thinks, right? And he basically said, look, black folks are watching this going, okay, all right, now we hear the defense lawyer talking about, well, maybe he had a heart condition or he was doing drugs or there was something that led to his death. And so you could see that he was kind of talking and speaking for black folks, saying, mm-hmm. now we're watching this with the side eye. So mm-hmm. how do you watch this if you are African-American, of African-American descent, and stay hopeful of an outcome that you think will serve justice?
That's a huge question. So I think there's no easy answer for that. I think what many black people do is hope for the best mm-hmm. and expect and anticipate the worst, right? And so the worst being that he gets off. And so I think in those moments, what you do is you watch with an eye for really supporting the prosecution because, you know, as the brother laid it out today, I was like, well, he's saying all the right things. And so any reasonable person, I think, would look at that. Now, I'm not an attorney like my brother, Professor Outlaw, but any reasonable person should look at that and say, okay, I'm convinced. But so that I think that's how a lot of us are looking at it. And I'm also hopeful that, you know, about the fact that the prosecution is black, right? There's a black person on there. So you know that there's somebody at the table mm-hmm. with some insights into how we think about these things. So I think you hold on to those pieces, and those are the pieces that keep you hopeful. There's not anybody arguing at the table in a leadership position that you're like, oh, they have no clue what they're talking about. They don't get it. Mm-hmm. And this brother gets it from a visceral perspective as a black male in mm-hmm. the United States. So I think that's the part that keeps us hopeful. I think the reality is for a lot of us that the other side of it is we've seen way too many times, and we've heard way too many times that it goes the other way. So I think you pick out those things that give you hope, and you hang your hat on those. But you also are also very realistic in recognizing that it's possible it may not go the way of justice. And I think that's how we do it. You have to hold, right, the double consciousness. You have to hold both of those things in your spirit at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Going back to W.E.B. Du Bois. In our last few moments, Professor Outlaw, I believe I heard today that Attorney Blackwell was not supposed to give the opening statement. And that it was supposed to be another one on the attorney team, and he might have even been white. So to Dr. Alfie's point, did that matter that it was an African-American giving that opening statement, an African-American attorney?
Oh, I definitely think it is. You know, trials, you know, there is some theater to trial,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, in some ways, it's theater. You are trying to present a case, but appearances, words, how you move, the words you use, they matter. And I think it does matter, as Dr. Noble pointed out, that a black man was standing up there and saying, we're going to prove to you that this white officer needlessly and cruelly took the life of a black man, that there was no reason for it. And so I think that does matter. And I think it also matters to the community, as Dr. Noble says, in trying to bring legitimacy to the process, and black people in particular looking at this and saying, we want somebody who really does understand
Amen.
what we go through on a daily basis about our fears of walking out and not coming home, of our children walking out and not coming home because some officer perceives them as a threat or just, you know, takes their badge, uses their badge as immunity to go and harm and kill us. Mm-hmm. That those symbols, those that message does matter, and it does. It's a message of trying to bring legitimacy to the process, and I think it is very important.
Professor Lucius Outlaw, associate professor with Howard University School of Law, and Dr. Alfie Nobe, psychologist and founder of ACOMA Project, a mental health nonprofit organization. Thank you both so much for illuminating this very important issue and conversation. We thank you again for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Thank you much for having me.
That's the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Monday, March 29th. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Have a great night.